Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort back in KZYX's Philo Studio, welcoming you to the July 11th edition of Takes on the World, a program, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you. Before I went away, I lined up Professor Miguel Tinker Salas at the University of Pomona, who is an expert on the Americas, to speak about the presidential elections in Mexico, which are yet to take place, knowing in advance that the results were likely to be controversial and disappointing, at least from my perspective, and that of millions of Mexicans, both in Mexico and here, and contested by an opposition long used to the political chicanery that's inherent in that country's elections. Not that we haven't seen it here, it's squared, but in Mexico people actually care enough about it to take to the streets as they did in the last election. Tens of thousands have done so. In sum, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, which was voted out of office in 2006 after ruthlessly ruling Mexico for 71 years, was returned to power on July 1st, when unofficial election results indicated that its presidential candidate, Enrique Peña Nieto, had defeated two opponents, although by a smaller margin than some observers expected, a result that was confirmed by Mexican election officials on Friday after a partial recount. Peña Nieto reportedly won 38% of the vote, with a candidate of the Democratic Revolutionary Party, or PRD, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, receiving 32%. Josefina Vázquez Mota of the conservative PAN party got 25%. The final results were in line with the preliminary count reported shortly after polls closed on that Sunday, but López Obrador, who in 2006 lost by a sliver to the current president, Felipe Calderón, is claiming fraud, citing news media and social media reports of vote buying and calling for a total recount. He said, "More and more we have elements that support the hypothesis that the presidential election was bought by those who do not want change in our country," said López Obrador. The final results were in line with the preliminary court count reported shortly after polls closed on Sunday, July 1st, but López Obrador is claiming fraud, and actually during a news conference he held on Thursday, his lectern was covered with prepaid gift cards that he said pre-supporters had handed out to voters to secure their votes. López Obrador's accusations were confirmed to me by telephone from a friend in Mexico City who had been in Michoacán the day of the election and saw the cards in both places. López Obrador has until tomorrow to submit a formal complaint to the Federal Electoral Tribunal, which has the power to annul federal elections, although it has never done so, and is likely to do so when an establishment candidate, quote-unquote, wins. On Saturday, a rally of students, unionists, and what the New York Times described as leftists in the central Zocalo Plaza, estimated by Mexican city officials to be 50,000, marched with signs reading, "Peña, how much did it cost to become president? And Mexico, you pawned your future for 500 pesos. Mexico city officials put the size of the crowd at 50,000. Protesters who carried signs in English, Japanese, French, German, and other languages to call the attention of the international press to the situation. They were not the only ones who clearly felt the need for change. Confidence in the ruling National Action Party, or PAN, of President Felipe Calderón plummeted in the face of an army-led war against the country's well-armed drug cartels that has been an absolute failure and resulted in the deaths of an estimated 60,000 people in the last 5 years with nothing positive to show for it. In an op-ed piece in the New York Times last Wednesday, Peña Nieto addressed what he apparently believes is his most important audience, the American liberal intelligentsia that had little respect for the PRI when it was in power. "To those concerned about a return to the old ways," he wrote, "fear not. At 45, I am part of a generation of pre-politicians committed to democracy. I reject the practices of the past in the same way I seek to move forward from the political gridlock of the present. My generation's objective is not ideology or patronage, but measurable success at liberating Mexico from poverty. That is how I govern the state of Mexico, the country's most populous from 2005 to 2011. I will govern with pragmatic realism and a clear long-term strategy, he continued. Developing countries like India, China, and Brazil have shown the way to significant and lasting poverty alleviation through institutional reforms and economic policies focused on growth. It's time for those improvements to come to Mexico. Enrique Peña Nieto goes on, I want to address the issue of organized crime and drug trafficking head on. There can be neither negotiation nor truce with criminals. I respect President Felipe Calderon for his commitment to ending this scourge. I will continue the fight, but the strategy must change. With over 60,000 deaths in the past 6 years, considerable criticism from human rights groups, and deliberate progress in stemming the flow of drugs, current policies must be reexamined. End quote. Enrique Peña Nieto. So what does he plan on doing that's different from his predecessor? Indeed, he writes, I propose initiatives that will result in a marked increase in security spending and have set as a public goal slashing violent crime significantly. What must be improved is coordination among federal, state, and municipal crime-fighting authorities. I will create a 40,000-person National Guard gendarmerie, I guess, a police force similar to those in countries like Colombia, Italy, and France, to focus on the most violent rural areas. I will expand the federal police by at least 35,000 officers and bolster intelligence gathering and analysis. I will consolidate the state and municipal police forces and provide greater federal oversight to crack down on corruption within their ranks. And Peña Nieto goes on, I will propose comprehensive criminal law reform. I have already sought out the advice of General Oscar Naranjo, who recently retired as Colombia's national police chief and is one of the world's top crime fighters, end quote. Those are the words of Enrique Peña Nieto, newly elected president of Mexico, writing in last Wednesday's New York Times. At about 20 minutes past the hour, when I speak with Professor Tinker Salas, we'll examine the results of the elections and what we can expect from Mexico in the coming months. Meanwhile, let's get back to a familiar subject. Who decides U.S. Middle East policy, and who thinks they should? On Monday, the Debka File, an Israeli online intelligence news service, reported to have close ties to the Mossad, launched a stinging attack against President Obama, because, Debka File declared, he had broken a promise to a group of prominent American Jewish leaders, presumably speaking for the Israeli government, not to meet with Egypt's new president, Mohamed Morsi, unless Morsi fulfilled certain requirements, determined not by Obama, but by Israel and those Jewish leaders. Here's how Debka described it, quote, Israeli government and military leaders were taken aback by the news of U.S. President Barack Obama's invitation to the new Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, to visit Washington in September. In breach of the president's assurances to the U.S. Jewish leaders at the White House last month, Debka files exclusive Washington and Jerusalem sources report. His key assurance was that Morsi would not be invited to the White House and Obama would not maintain direct telephone contact with him until he met certain conditions, the foremost of which concerned a public and unambiguous commitment to Egypt's 1979 peace treaty with Israel. It goes on. The American Jewish delegation was assured that President Morsi would be required to devote a section of his earliest speech on foreign affairs to the specific affirmation of his profound commitment to the peace pact with Israel. The unspecific pledge to hold Cairo's international accords he made upon his election on June 24th would not satisfy the U.S. president, the American Jewish delegation was promised. Indeed, the new Egyptian president would also be required to table the peace pact with Israel in the new Egyptian parliament for ratification. With these assurances, the Debka File reported, the Jewish delegation was satisfied. However, the article went on, it turned out Monday that instead of standing by his promises, President Obama had sent Deputy Secretary of State William Burns to Cairo for 2 days of interviews with Egyptian officials, in none of which did future relations with Israel figure. President Morsi's spokesman then announced that the U.S. official had handed the new president an invitation to visit the White House in September. Neither Burns nor the White House contradicted him. Furthermore, in briefing to reporters after he saw Morsi, Burns vehemently denied that the peace pact had been discussed. Well, next Saturday, July 14th, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is due in Cairo after a visit to Israel, notes Debka, and we can expect Clinton to bring U.S. policy towards Egypt back in line with Israel's demands. That last statement is my opinion, not Debka's. In Jerusalem, writes Debka File, the Obama administration is seen as suddenly backtracking on the conditions set for the incoming Egyptian president in the last week of June, which essentially made U.S. support of his regime conditional on his performance on eight key demands, among which are, quote, making the 1979 peace treaty between Egypt and Israel a central pillar of his foreign policy, public information of his commitment to uphold peace, public affirmation of his commitment to uphold peace relations with Israel, and a resolute effort to curb the terrorist elements running wild in the Sinai and threatening Israeli security by restoring Egyptian control. Not until all the eight steps are taken will President Morsi be welcome in Washington as an official guest. Furthermore, the Debka File reported, quote, not until the Egyptian president has satisfied Washington on all these scores will the Obama administration use its influence with the World Bank to ease Egypt's dire liquidity problems and help find the cash to buy food on world markets. If Morsi can't find the money to feed the population, hungry Egyptians will be out on the streets of their cities once again, clamoring this time for his and the Muslim Brotherhood's removal, end quote. Those conditions, conclude Debka File, have mostly gone by the board, along with President Obama's promises. Okay, that's what Debka File has to tell you. Now I say, by what right, we need to ask, do these so-called, quote-unquote, Jewish leaders, arrogantly acting as agents for Israel, have in telling the President of the United States who he shouldn't meet with or talk to and use him to determine the foreign policy of the new Egyptian government? They have none, of course, and Obama should have immediately booted a lot of them from his office and had them frog march to the Foreign Agents Registration Office of the Justice Department to be registered as agents for a foreign country. Of course, thanks to their clout, even AIPAC, the biggest foreign lobby of them all, doesn't have to do that. President Obama, whatever his personal feelings, knows, as do those Jewish leaders, who runs Washington, who controls Congress, and who controls the mainstream media when it comes to matters concerning Israel, where Obama's support is almost invisible and where virtually every day there's another call in the press for him to get ready to attack Iran. He also knows and is reminded every day that he is losing crucial support among Jewish voters leading up to Election Day, and equally important, support from key Jewish funders from 2008 who've either abandoned him for Romney or have kept their wallets shut. That's a story that does appear with regularity in the mainstream and Jewish media, but what I've just read to you from the Israeli Debka File will not, and you won't find it in our alternative media as well. The truth is that when it comes to Israeli and American Jewish leaders telling an American president what he can and cannot do, it's an old story that began with Nixon's days in office and continued up to the signing of the Oslo Agreement in 1993, during which Israel and Jewish leaders in the U.S., backed by Congress, would not permit any U.S. official from the president on down to talk to a representative of the PLO until the PLO had recognized Israel's right to exist, a qualification set by Nixon's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. I should note that thanks to the legislation passed by the Israeli-controlled Congress, the same prohibition now applies to the president and any U.S. official meeting with a representative of the government of Iran, with one difference. They have to ask permission of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House 15 days before any meeting would take place and get the committee's approval. When in August 1979, one-time civil rights leader and U.S. ambassador under Carter, Jimmy Carter, Andrew Young, was revealed in Israeli press to have met with the PLO's U.N. representative, Zudi Terzi, Young was forced to resign. Rather than exacerbate the resulting verbal warfare that began between black and Jewish leaders of that day, Young was the one to apologize. 7 months later, in March of 1980, President Carter himself was forced to apologize after Young's replacement as UN ambassador, Donald McHenry, voted for a resolution that condemned Israel's settlement policies in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, and which called on Israel to dismantle them. In June of that year, after Carter requested a halt to Jewish settlements and his Secretary of State Ed Muskie called the settlements an obstacle to peace, a refrain from the State Department that has now become as familiar as it is toothless, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin announced plans to construct 10 new settlements. That was 32 years ago. But it's a pattern that has become all too familiar over the years, in which no president, Democrat or Republican, has escaped humiliation at the hands of an Israeli prime minister for attempting to follow established U.S. policy. And yet it's a fact, and an important one, that not even Israel's most notable critics, such as Noam Chomsky or Norman Finkelstein, ever write or talk about, since it would undermine seriously their mistaken idea that Israel is a client state of Washington rather than the other way around. Even to raise such an issue gets one targeted as an anti-Semite, but happily that smear applied to critics of Israel is fast losing its power to intimidate. The New York Times reports that the U.S. has moved significant military reinforcements into the Persian Gulf to deter the Iranian military from any possible attempt to shut down the Strait of Hormuz and to increase the number of fighter jets capable of striking deep into Iran if the standoff over its nuclear program escalates. The deployment of deployments are part of a long-planned effort to bolster the American military presence in the Gulf region, in part to reassure Israel that in dealing with Iran, as one senior administration official put it last week, when the president says there's no other option on the table beyond negotiations, when there are other options on the table beyond negotiations, he means it. Get ready for another war. Finally, proving corporations are doing what's best for their bottom line. Even before the defeat of the Walmart expansion project, the owners of Safeway, Raley's, and Save Mart, which is the owner of Lucky and Food Max, began an assault on their workers, wages, and benefits, and they and their union, UFCW Local 5, have been fighting back. Last night was a deadline for Lucky, Save Mart, and the union, after federal mediation, to come up with an offer to submit to the members who have been working without a contract since last September. The company had previously agreed to rescind its plans to invoke ratios that would lead to massive pay reductions and layoffs throughout Northern California. As of this morning, I have no results from last night's meeting.